Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV and recorded in London on Thursday, 6th of May. I'm Cindy Yu, the Spectator's broadcast editor, standing in for Andrew Neil. On the show today, I'll be speaking to Neil Ferguson, not the Imperial College epidemiologist, but a historian who coined the term Chimerica. He writes the Spectator's cover article this week and we'll be discussing Cold War II and more. We'll also be joined by Jay Bhattacharya, the Stanford Professor of Medicine who was one of the authors of the Great Barrington Declaration about whether the Indian government should lock down. Before all that, we'll chat local elections and ask, has Boris Johnson only just realised the cost of childcare in this country? All that to come in the next hour. If you enjoy the show and don't want to miss a future episode, click the subscribe button on the bottom right of your screen to follow our YouTube channel for free. First, it's Super Thursday. A flurry of elections across the UK are happening, from polls in Scotland and Wales to local elections and mayoralties across England. There's even a by-election in Hartlepool, a Red Wall seat that doesn't look certain to stay Labour. So what should you be watching out for as the results trickling over the next few days? Joining me now is The Spectator's political editor James Forsyth and our associate editor Isabel Hardman. James, let's talk about Super Thursday in just a moment, but for now, as we film, there are a couple of Royal Navy boats in the English Channel patrolling against a French barricade. What's going on?
So there has been a dispute about how many licences are being granted to French fishermen to fish off the coast of Jersey. The dispute massively escalated when the French suggested that Jersey's electricity supply, which largely comes from France, might be cut off if this situation wasn't sorted out. Then there was word of French fishing vessels heading to kind of blockade the port of St Helier. And the British government have responded by sending two Royal Navy vessels there to kind of make a statement and prevent a blockade. And I think the danger, I think there is clearly the initial French threat was incendiary. I think Boris Johnson was talking in his Downing Street statement last night about the need to calm the situation down while sending two Royal Navy vessels, which might be slightly contradictory. But on a more serious level, there is a problem here, which is that these post-Brexit disputes between the UK and the EU escalate very quickly. And this isn't a healthy state for this relationship to be in. I thought there was kind of an irony that last night you had a long and detailed G7 communique issued, which was meant to be part of the free world beginning to push back on Russia and China. And then the two largest military powers in Europe are both sending vessels from their own navy to the Channel in relation to a fishing dispute. This is not sensible. And I mean the two sides need to find a much better way of de-escalating these arguments before they reach this stage. I think unless they can do that, this is going to set up a very antagonistic, choppy relationship from now on. And it's really hard to imagine that this won't at some point bleed over into kind of into foreign and defence policy cooperation. You know, the UK and French navies are meant to cooperate very closely. They are now, you know, facing off against each other in the Channel. Now, I don't think anyone is expecting this situation to result in kind of any kind of action of that sort. But it is still not healthy for the UK-EU relationship to get to kind of battle stations quite so quickly whenever a relatively minor dispute, and this is a very minor dispute, occurs.
Yes, absolutely. But Isabel, all eyes are on the local elections across the country today, as well as happening in Wales and Scotland. We've also got the mayoralties. What are the places that we should be watching out for?
Well, we'll likely get the Hartlepool by-election result first, which, as we've said on Coffee House Shots podcasts, will probably set the narrative for the next few days as the other results come in. The other contests to really keep an eye on are the West Midlands mayoral contest, where there's not just a row about who thinks they're going to win. You've got Liam Byrne, who's briefing very stridently that he is going to win, despite polls suggesting otherwise. But you've also got frustration within the Labour Party towards Liam Byrne for being quite so strident ahead of the polls, because it then makes the West Midlands contest a bit like Hartlepool, in the sense that if Labour loses that, then it becomes a problem for Keir Starmer as well. So those around the Labour leader are basically saying, thanks Liam for that, you know, you could have just stayed a bit quieter or seemed a little bit more humble in the run-up to this result. We then have the results in Scotland, which are going to be very interesting to see how much of an impact Anna Sarwar has made in 10 weeks of being the new Scottish Labour leader. And we've had, if you look at the visits that Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer made yesterday in the final hours of campaigning, Keir Starmer was in Pontefract, he was in the West Midlands, and he was also in the West of England on the mayoral campaign trail there as well. So those are clearly areas that they're concerned about. And similarly, Boris Johnson was supporting Andy Street, the Tory candidate, to be re-elected as West Midlands mayor.
James, how are the Tories feeling about all of these elections, and in particular in Hartlepool?
I think the problem for the Tories is that their expectations management has gone rather awry, to put it mildly. There is now kind of assumption in Westminster that the Tories will win Hartlepool, the West Midlands mayoralty and Teesside. Now, if the Tories do win Hartlepool, I think it will create problems for Labour. It will suggest that, you know, that Keir Starmer hasn't managed to stop the bleeding in the red wall. But I think that from where we are now, even if Labour were to win Hartlepool on the kind of third recount by 10 votes, you know, I think Keir Starmer will be up there first thing tomorrow morning proclaiming a historic victory and saying the Labour fight back starts here. So I mean, there is an expectations management problem for the Tories. My expectation is that the incumbent party in England, Scotland and Wales, so in England that's the Tories, in Scotland that's the SNP, and in Wales it's the Labour Party, will all do fairly well, because they have answers to voters on what have they done for you lately. They'll point to the furlough scheme and the vaccine rollout. And I mean, we are still seeing that in this crisis, voters are tending to give the government, the incumbent, whether they be the Westminster government or the devolved governments in Scotland and Wales, you know, the benefit of the doubt.
Mm. Isabel, obviously we're filming at a time where the results are not out yet, but as you alluded to, if Keir Starmer loses Hartlepool, he could have a problem on his hands. How big of a problem do you think that would be? Because clearly, you know, if Keir Starmer loses a Red Wall seat, the narrative is no longer that Jeremy Corbyn was the problem.
Yeah, so I don't think you're going to see a leadership challenge, but what I think you are going to see, or at least hear, is a lot of complaining, not just from the left of the Labour Party, who would obviously seize on this as a sign that the Starmer project to rescue the Labour Party from the Corbynites is not working, but also from those who have wanted Keir Starmer to do well and have seen him as a potential saviour of the party after its very torrid past 5 or 6 years. I think you'll see party grandees giving those sort of coded interviews that you see after an embarrassing result for a party, where they don't lay into the Labour leader, but they start to say, and I think, you know, the great thing about Keir is he really can turn up the volume, or something like that, where they're basically setting out what he needs to do in their view to improve matters and to stop the party from continuing to bleed red wall votes. One thing I've picked up that's really interesting from those around the by-election campaign and around Starmer is they've been quite keen to emphasise that voters aren't as angry this time round on the doorstep as they have been in the past three elections. Now, that's an interesting argument. It may well be true anecdotally, and something that has given the activists who've campaigned in Hartlepool at least some comfort that the voters aren't shouting at them anymore. But if the voters were not angry but still not voting for Labour, I'm not really sure how that improves the party's prospects, because, you know, people might feel sort of more fondly towards Labour, but if they just see it as being something that they can discard to the history books, then that's not really a measure of success for Keir Starmer. So you will see a lot of pressure for him to move on, I think, from what a lot of his anxious friends in the Labour Party see as being a bit of bandwagon jumping, but also a caution around certain things. There's a mix of frustration that he can be knocked around by rows on Twitter and shadow cabinet members who come to him saying people are getting very cross about this thing on Twitter, therefore we have to take a position. And I'm thinking particularly of the measures on protest that the government is currently legislating for, that Keir Starmer has now decided to oppose the entire bill containing that, which has got, you know, tougher sentences for criminals committing a range of offences. And there's a lot of people on Labour's front bench who are saying, well, how on earth did we end up in this position where we're appearing to not want to be tough on crime? But also, I think you'll also see people saying, well, but he's also at the same time as jumping on bandwagons, he's incredibly cautious and he doesn't make the big calls when he needs to. He waits until it's inevitable that something's going to be announced, almost to the point that actually journalists have had the operational note saying it's going to happen. And then he calls for it, saying the government really needs to go for this, knowing full well that the government is going to go for it. And they want him to be a little bit more fleet of foot.
Now, one place that Labour may do quite well in is Wales with Mark Drakeford. But James, that's looking pretty tight, isn't it?
Yeah, the Tories did very well in Wales in the 2019 general election. But, I mean, the polls at the moment seem to suggest that Labour will remain as the largest party in Wales, even if short of a majority. And I think you see there, you know, that, again, I think Labour in Wales are benefiting from the vaccination rollout. I think Wales is further ahead on the vaccination programme than any other part of the UK. But I think this is, I think there is the challenge for Labour is going to be working out, you know, I think it's actually not overreacting to these results. I think the danger is that the left of the Labour Party, who feel, and they have a point on this, that Keir Starmer kind of campaigned for Labour leader, almost offering a kind of Corbynite policy prospectus, but just without Jeremy Corbyn and his own personal baggage. I think it is fair to say that as leader, that has not been the approach that he has taken. So I think you will see a lot of noises off from the Labour left if Labour have a bad set of results tonight. And at the same time, as Isabel said, it's hard to say what Labour is for. I think, you know, Labour's attacks on Sleaze have almost been... They have almost gone so hard on Sleaze because they haven't got anything else to say. And at the moment, it's quite hard to sum up what Labour's offer to the electorate is.
And Isabel, when it comes to Labour north of the border, they might be doing better than they were before. You interviewed the Scottish Labour leader, Anna Sarwar, for the magazine this week. Can you tell us what he was like?
Yeah, he's the one who's had the momentum in this Holyrood election campaign. He's the one who, as he says in my interview, has enjoyed this campaign. Nicola Sturgeon obviously started this election campaign in a very uncomfortable position, given the row over her destroyed relationship with Alex Salmond and her former mentor's decision to set up a new political party that he claims will help the cause of independence, but is obviously part of his sort of revenge project against Nicola Sturgeon. And then you've got the Scottish Conservatives, who are still so obviously desperately missing Ruth Davidson, to the extent that she often appears far more prominently on their campaign leaflets and in their media opportunities than the actual leader, Douglas Ross, who's had quite a wooden performance in these elections. So Anna Sarwar is the one who has got a bit more freedom to enjoy himself, and his pitch is not to talk about the constitution, but to say that it's important to focus on a national plan for recovery and to talk about this being a pandemic election rather than just to go on and on about independence. If you look at Scottish Conservative leaflets in particular, they are basically saying, stop a referendum, vote Conservative to stop a referendum. Whereas his strategy for Labour is to talk to people who may have voted yes in 2014, who might still be minded to support independence in future, but he wants to try and bring them on side so that Scottish Labour can go back to being the official opposition in the Scottish Parliament.
Yeah, he certainly looks like he's having fun. Actually, there was that video that went viral recently of him dancing to Uptown Funk, which we can watch a bit of now. And Isabel, you mentioned that Douglas Ross was a bit wooden, and actually I did cringe a little bit when I saw his response to popular culture references. Here's Douglas Ross.
Come on, talk us through your dance routine if it comes to a dance-off for second place.
Well, I've made it very clear, you know, I am a big fan of Atomic Kitten Hole Again. Not only can I sing the lyrics without the computer screen and I don't need the words to it, you know, I've made up my own actions to it, and it just makes a whole performance. So, you know, if you see me walking down the street, staring at the sky, dragging my 2 feet, you just pass me by, it still makes me cry. But Colin, you can make me whole again.
Well, let me also bring in Stephen Daisley, who is a Spectator contributor and a columnist for the Scottish Daily Mail. Stephen, having seen those two videos side by side, you know, who would you say is a more charismatic leader? Who would you vote for?
Well, I don't think that there's much in it. Insofar as I think, you know, as Isabel has just said, you know, Anna Sarwar has had a campaign that he's clearly enjoyed. In fact, it reminds me of the campaign that Ruth Davidson had in 2015 for the general election, where her way of thinking was that, you know, there's no way that the Scottish Conservatives were going to do well in the 2015 general election, so I'll spend this election, you know, going out, having fun, drumming up media interest, and I can then build on that for future elections, which she then did to quite some success. And Anna Sarwar seems to be doing something very similar. You know, Douglas Ross, it's, you know, I almost feel sorry for him, hard-hearted cynic though I am, in that, you know, Douglas Ross has actually, you know, put out a manifesto and that is, you know, to some extent actually quite well costed. There's lots of interesting policies in there, sort of things like funding for mental health and, you know, how do we address care, social care after the pandemic and all these things. But the problem is that his messaging has been largely about independence and him sort of standing, you know, almost kind of angrily pointing and saying, independence is a terrible thing and vote for us if you don't want it. And, you know, the more he kind of talks about how terrible independence is, voters seem to think, actually, maybe it's not independence that's terrible, Douglas.
I mean, Stephen, on Anna Sarwar's campaign, I found a blog that you wrote for Coffee House recently, very interesting, talking about, you know, this is not a constitutional election way of talking about things. But you were saying that he's actually playing that card a bit too soon, that he should be waiting a few more years before he says, guys, let's not talk about the referendum now.
Yeah, I wonder about, you know, I think that, you know, on the face of it, Anna Sarwar has sort of won the battle of the campaigns, if there's really such a thing as that outside of the political bubble. I do wonder though if there was an opportunity at this election for Anna Sarwar actually to have targeted sort of more traditionally pro-union voters with a sort of a solid message on the union, which, you know, Scottish Labour has gone all over the place on the union in the past few years. And, you know, and I do wonder if perhaps he could have gone a bit, you know, he could have solidified the message on the union, you know, appealed away some of the more sort of soft Tory voters, and then, you know, had a chance at going into second place. He might still do that, but I think that it's, you know, as things stand right now, I think it's probably more likely that the Tories will hold on to second place. And if he'd done that this time, you know, then, you know, 5 years from now, he could have gone for the uptown funk, upbeat, positive campaign. But, you know, who knows? We will find out in the next 48 hours or so who was right and who was wrong.
Yes. James, what do you reckon? Could Anna Sarwar have a realistic chance at second place in this race?
I mean, as Stephen says, most of the polls indicate that the Scottish Tories will hang on to this. And it seems that kind of unionist tactical voting is most likely to benefit them rather than Scottish Labour. I think, though, that Anna Sarwar's emergence in this campaign is an important moment in terms of thinking about Scottish politics in the long term, because I think Anna Sarwar has a kind of credibility as First Minister that we haven't, as a potential First Minister, that we haven't seen from a Scottish Labour leader, or really the last two Scottish Tory leaders. And I think that will make a difference. I also think that in terms of any future campaign, you know, his ratings are positive. The more people have seen of him, the more they've liked of him. And that could be very important in terms of IndyRef too, because the kind of gaping gap in any kind of unionist campaign was someone who could appeal to social democratic voters who maybe lean towards independence because they don't like the idea of kind of Tory governments at Westminster, but aren't kind of full on nationalists. And I think he is quite well suited to appealing to that kind of voter come any second independence referendum.
Well, Stephen, let's talk about Nicola Sturgeon for a little bit. I mean, we've seen the psychodrama that's happened in Scotland over the last year or so. But despite Alex Salmond's best efforts, Nicola Sturgeon is still in place and she still looks set to be First Minister. So has all of this just shown how Teflon she is?
I think, yes, it has. It's shown how Teflon Nicola Sturgeon is, but also has shown that, you know, the SNP has this built-in, baked-in vote that is sort of roughly 40 to 45% of the electorate. That 45% number will sound familiar because, of course, that's the percentage of Scots who voted for independence in 2014. And the SNP's message is essentially, you know, stick with us and, you know, that will be the surest way to get independence. It's sort of reminiscent of the old liberal slogan in the 70s, you know, one last heave. And Nicola Sturgeon's sort of gradualist approach echoes that in some ways. It's true that, you know, Alex Salmond has certainly not made much of an impact or not much of a positive impact on this campaign. I think the most commented about of the Alibi party has been its sort of technical snafus, its various launches, and also that really very weird video that it did where it appeared to have summoned up the spirit of Robert the Bruce from 700 years ago to a sort of rant about breaking the spine of English superiority at Bannockburn, which is very strange, but, you know, that appeals to the kind of sort of, you know, hardcore nationalist voter that Alex Salmond is pitching to. You know, his message is give Alibi, give me your second vote, your list vote, and, you know, we will sort of, if you like, strengthen the SNP's spine. But, you know, I would say Nicola Sturgeon has, you know, she is going to be the First Minister, you know, after this election. There's no doubt about that. I would say we're talking earlier about who enjoyed the campaigns. Nicola Sturgeon has not looked like she has enjoyed this campaign. You know, she has looked like this was a grin and bear it campaign. And, you know, in some ways, I suppose you can't blame her. She's coming off the back of, you know, these very punishing Holyrood inquiries and the fact that at the centre of it was something, you know, deeply personal for her, the breakup of this, you know, decades-long political relationship with Alex Salmond. I think as well there's maybe a bit of a frustration there that, you know, as we've seen, that although the polls are good for the SNP right now, they're not necessarily good for independence. And in some polls are actually going in the other direction, and you're seeing support for independence drop. So Nicola Sturgeon, you know, could be in the position where she wins this election, even wins an outright majority at Holyrood, but at the same time that polls turn against Scottish independence, which is, you know, sod's law writ large.
Stephen, looking ahead, has Nicola Sturgeon boxed herself in a little bit when it comes to a second referendum? Because she's ruled out a wildcat referendum, an illegal one that Westminster does not sanction. But at the same time, she's pledged to get a referendum within 2.5 years of her being re-elected.
I mean, Nicola Sturgeon has set herself a very, very difficult task. And now Nicola Sturgeon has, you know, completed many, many difficult tasks. And remember, this is the woman who, you know, was responsible for that famous 2015 SNP landslide that wiped out but wiped out the Scottish Labour Party. You know, she, you know, had a setback in 2017 and then roared right back in 2019. So she's, you know, incredibly capable politician. But the sort of high bar she has to reach now on a second referendum is possibly too high even for her. You know, she has an activist base and also backbenchers who are really impatient for a second referendum. Her argument in this campaign is that you know Westminster can't silence Scotland's voice. Okay, that's fair enough. But if you then do get this majority, which Nicola Sturgeon claims is a mandate for a second referendum, then eventually you're going to have to demand that referendum and at some point ideally deliver that referendum. And the problem is, if Westminster says no, and that seems to be what Boris Johnson is minded to do just now, it is one of those, you know, you and whose army sort of questions. Potentially, it has been hinted that the Scottish government could, you know, sort of go ahead with a referendum bill and allow this to be tested in the courts. Problem with that is, first of all, you know, it looks a bit ambulance chasing that you're suing your way or you're sort of being sued out of going for independence. Also, You know, what happens if the court say no, this the constitution is reserved to Westminster, and then Nicola Sturgeon is left with a majority at Holyrood, a very unhappy base and potentially parliamentary party, and no feasible way of achieving a referendum that she really has to achieve to keep her coalition together.
James Forsyth, Isabel Hardman and Stephen Daisley, thank you for joining Spectator TV. Now, the Prime Minister has been dogged by stories surrounding his flat renovations in the run-up to these elections, but it might not be the only thing that Boris Johnson has tried to get Tory donors to pay for. Number 10 is refusing to deny reports that the Prime Minister approached a donor to pay for baby Wilfred's childcare. In this week's magazine, journalist Isabel Oakeshott lays out the costs of childcare in the UK these days and asks, has the Prime Minister only just realised how expensive it is? She joins the programme now. Isabel Oakeshott, welcome to Spectator TV. Now, you've been doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations. Tell us about this.
Well, this is an exercise I'd completely avoided doing for all these years, mainly because I just didn't really want to know what the total amount that I had spent on childcare has been. My oldest child is now nearly 14. My youngest is 8. And so obviously I've had a very long period of paying for childcare full time. I've worked all the way through. And when I read that Boris apparently has been struggling a little bit with the extra cost of finding childcare for his baby, Wilfred, I kind of thought, actually, you know what, it really is. I have some sympathy here. It really is a big hit. Although Boris, being the father of 6 children that we know of, you would have thought by now this wouldn't have come as a surprise to him. So I thought, look, this is time to face facts. Let's have a look at how much I've spent over the years. And it was very much back of the envelope because like any parent, full-time working parent, my childcare arrangements are complicated. I don't just have a full-time nanny. I also, until Brexit destroyed the au pair market, I also had an au pair because I need overnight help sometimes. And, you know, often there's extra help at odd times of day and night and weekends. So I really just took a kind of a general figure of how much it costs to have had a nanny for all these years. And the figure I came out with was, I'm afraid, well over £500,000. Honestly, I am actually still slightly in shock, even though I knew that it was going to be a big figure. I mean, that is one hell of a sum. And, you know, to some extent, it's prompted a bit of soul searching. You know, how could I have spent that amount on childcare? I mean, have I been unbelievably stupid? Was there a better way of doing things? And, you know, many people hearing that figure will think, my goodness, she must have had no time at all with her children. And actually, ironically, that isn't true. I'm lucky enough for the last few years, certainly, to have had an enormous amount of flexibility over the way I work. And actually, I do the school run most days, one of the school runs, because there are multiple school runs to do. You know, and I'm lucky enough to spend probably considerably more time with the children than most working parents. The reality is that £500,000 is probably not that unusual for professional parents, either single parents like me or where there are two working parents in the household and they need full-time care over a very long period. So, you know, I'm sort of slowly recovering from the shock.
I also did some quick back of the envelope calculations and worked out the annual cost of that, around £36,000, and that's after tax. So, you know, you'd have to have a partner or be earning quite a lot before tax in order to afford that. And Isabel, why is it so expensive? As you say, you've not been stupid about it. So where does the cost come from?
So essentially, with a full-time nanny, you are paying for a professional and you're paying a decent salary for somebody of the caliber that you will be as a mother or father happy to leave your children with. And rightly, they have to be paid properly through all the normal channels. You've got to pay national insurance contributions. You are effectively an employer running a mini business, as it were. And good nannies are hard to find and they rightly command decent salaries. And in terms of trying to get something cheaper, perhaps the sort of the most flexible model there is, if you're trying to avoid going down the very expensive nanny route, is a childminder, and these are people that tend to look after a small group of children in their own homes. They're allowed to look after up to 8 of different age groups, and they are actually a relatively affordable solution for parents that don't want to put their little ones in nursery for whatever reason, or nurseries don't offer the flexibility. The difficulty with childminders is that A, they can be quite hard to find, they're in hot demand, and B, they don't have quite the setup that you as a parent want. You know, perhaps their house isn't big enough, they don't have quite a big enough garden. You know, you may as a mother not particularly want your child to be with the mix that that childminder has at that time. So I think for a lot of professionals, a nanny is the only answer. And, you know, in fairness, when I think about my £500,000, I've had a lot for my money. You know, my fabulous nanny, I'm lucky enough to have had the same lady for the last 7 years, which has just been a godsend. And she does an awful lot more than look after the children. And I think as children get older, a lot of professional families, they keep their nannies on to do so many other things other than the sort of traditional childcare role. But this isn't something that comes cheap. And, you know, for me, it is effectively a cost of doing business, of running the household and doing what I do. And in all these years, I know that my children have had, you know, the highest quality childcare that I could afford. But that doesn't still take away from me kind of thinking, what else could I have spent that money on?
Yes, and it makes a lot of sense when you think that, you know, for example, the OECD says that childcare costs take up to average woman's half of their salary. So, I mean, that's a hefty cost, as you've talked about. You mentioned au pairs and how Brexit has impacted that. Presumably that's because the stop to freedom of movement, and there's not a specific au pair visa for these young European women who come here to learn a bit of culture and in exchange for their childcare services. You were a vocal supporter of Brexit, and that's...
I know where this is going.
But maybe
if I'd known it was going to destroy the au pair market, I might have thought differently. What I would have thought, I didn't know, by the way, that there was going to be a total disaster with the au pair market when I supported Brexit. But of course, it wouldn't have made me feel any different about Brexit, because I would have assumed that this really wouldn't have been a difficult thing to sort out. You know, the government now is saying you should employ British people to do this. Well, this is insane. I mean, how many British people do you know who are prepared to work for £90 a week for 25 hours childcare living in someone else's house? Just doesn't stack up for most people. There may be some students that find that there is a way of fitting that round, and it's actually quite economic for them to do that because they've got free board and lodging and they're doing a bit of childcare around their courses. But the whole point of the au pair exchange program was that these young women, and many of them, you know, they are very young, they come over at 19, 20, are learning the language. That's the origins of the au pair cultural program. And so there is something in it for them beyond just having the, you know, free roof over their head and a bit of an adventure. And that has just completely gone. You know, you go on the Au Pair World website and you will see that there are dozens and dozens of parents chasing every single au pair that says they've got pre-settled status and so they are free to work in the UK. And, you know, talking informally to other parents, this has really hit families hard.
Mm. And finally, let's talk a little bit about Boris, which is why we're talking about the story at all, because whilst a lot of parents have been dealing with this, it's not really been in the news because I guess a lot of parents just think this is the way things are done. Not the Prime Minister, apparently, because he's reportedly been trying to get Tory donors to try to pay for Wilfred's childcare costs. What do you make of that? And do you think that's the sort of stuff that's actually going to be more important than the flat renovation story?
Well, it agitated me, but in a sort of conflicted way, as I say, because I have some sympathy for him in the cost of it. Look, I think that what people think is they feel that something is wrong here. They feel that it's extraordinary that someone of the Prime Minister's stature and independent means, because make no mistake, Boris Johnson is a very wealthy and successful individual. He was before he became Prime Minister. He commands huge fees for his writing and his books. How can he be scratching around and finding himself beholden to people, asking them to pay for his partner's gold wallpaper choices? People are, I think they're just a little incredulous about it. Is it cutting through? I think a bit. I think it was a slow burn, this story. It's been rumbling along for a long time. And only now, I think, allegation after allegation, it is beginning to cut through a bit. But the reality is, of course, people are dealing with far bigger issues. They still think Boris Johnson is a good prime minister. That's what the polls suggest. They certainly think he's better than anyone else who's putting their name forward for the job right now. And so I think he'll weather this pretty well. That said, there's clearly one or two things that he doesn't want to tell us about this sorry saga. And you know, when politicians keep avoiding the question, there's a reason for that. Something more is yet to come out. Would it bring him down? I'd be very, very surprised indeed. But it's uncomfortable. And you've got to feel for the couple themselves, you know, looking round at their gold wallpaper. Must have seriously taken the tinge off it. You know, really, are they enjoying their fancy lampshades? I can't imagine they really are.
Isabel Oakeshott, thanks very much. You can read Isabel's article and more of our print and online offerings with a Spectator subscription. As a thank you for watching the show, we'll even give you 12 weeks for just £12 and a £20 Amazon gift card. Go to spectator.co.uk/TV offer and sign up today. Next, the G7 are meeting in London this week, but the Indian delegation has had to self-isolate because of two cases of confirmed COVID in their midst, really bringing home the sheer scale of the infections in India at the moment. There are more than 350,000 new infections each day. The opposition in the country is calling for another national lockdown, but so far the government is resisting. In this week's issue of The Spectator, Stanford professor Jay Bhattacharya, you might remember having heard his name from the Great Barrington Declaration, explains just why the government is so reluctant to put the country into another lockdown. Jay, welcome to Spectator TV. So tell us, why is the Modi government so reluctant to impose another national lockdown?
The lockdown was tried in India, a draconian sharp lockdown imposed just sort of with almost no notice in the early days of the epidemic last year, and it had absolutely devastating consequences. Migrant workers, for instance, who work in cities were forced to walk, in some cases, hundreds, thousand miles to go home. Almost 900 died en route. Some people have called it like the India's Trail of Tears. It, in some ways, it's the biggest forced migration within India since the 1947 partition. And it was absolutely devastating. And if you have to ask also, in addition to all these harms from the immediate impositional lockdown, there are also longer term harms. Many, many programs that are vital to the health of Indians and actually the people around the world, programs like treating tuberculosis patients, you know, that takes a year of constant application of antibiotics, vaccination programs, basic vaccination programs for childhood diseases, a whole host of other health priorities were basically thrown out the window for the Indian lockdown. And with great harm to the health of the Indian population, enormous death. One UN report estimated that last year in India and South Asia at large, more than 200,000 children had died as a consequence of the nutritional deprivation and medical deprivation of the lockdown. The lockdown means something very different in the West than it does in the United States, than it does in India. And I think if you look at what happened with the first lockdown, I think that it's just an unimaginable thing to do, to have a sharp national lockdown in India again.
And you know, I think when it comes to the different health questions like tuberculosis vaccines, you know, that's something that we have heard about here in the West. But what we haven't heard about much is these migrant workers. You know, can you talk a little bit about the structure of the Indian economy and what these migrant workers are doing? And why do they have to return to their villages on foot? Why was that a situation at all?
I mean, it wasn't the lockdown was ordered with very, very short notice. And you know, the Indian economy, it is actually in some ways, it has grown much more sort of national in scope. There are people who work outside of their villages, but they find work in cities. They sell, you know, just for example, maybe you sell coconut water for a living, right? You buy the coconut water in the morning, you sell it, with the money you get, you buy your food for the day, and then you buy more coconut water that night that you sell the next morning, right? It's a cycle that you just repeat, and if it's broken, you go hungry that day. And the workers come there from their villages because that's where the opportunities are, into the cities. So when the lockdown was instituted, the government essentially said, go back to your home villages, quarantine your home villages. And that's why people were essentially had to go there very far with almost no provisions for many, many people, for the poorest, no provision of transportation. With predictable, devastating effects, just heartbreaking.
How much of it is the problem with how the government conducted lockdown? I mean, an Oxford University study found that India's lockdown last year was actually among the strictest in the world. Could there have been some kind of halfway house where they allowed the trains to still run, they had some health services going on, in the same way that the UK's second lockdown, for example, cancer services were not as pushed back as they were in the first lockdown? Is it a problem of how it was implemented rather than having a lockdown at all?
I mean, I think the problem is that lockdown, I'm sort of well known for not thinking that they worked very well in the West. But I think in India, it really was hopeless to actually. So what is a lockdown? A lockdown is an attempt to end human interaction or to pause human interaction, to make sure that people are apart from one another for an extended period of time so that they don't have spread COVID disease to one another. The problem with that is that in a nation like India, that is going to automatically have devastating consequences. And actually, the other side of it is, given the living arrangements of many, 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 many poor Indians, it was destined to fail to stop the spread of COVID. In the first wave of COVID, there have been a whole sequence of seroprevalence studies. A seroprevalence study is a study that checks the presence of antibodies in the population at large. Antibodies that suggest that someone has already been infected with COVID. There was a study done last, I think, July in Mumbai that found in the Dharavi slums that almost 60%, like 57% of the residents in July of last year had already been infected. Whereas at Mumbai at large, you know, a cosmopolitan city with many, many affluent people, the seroprevalence was only, I think, 16%. There was an enormous gap between the rich and the poor in who was exposed in the first wave in India. That lockdown, if anything, protected the affluent class, the class of people who could work from home and work through Zoom. It did absolutely nothing to protect the poor from the disease.
So at our current juncture then, if not lockdown, what do you think the Indian government should do?
I mean, I think the Indian government actually, one of the great things it's done is it's secured vaccines at a level that many, many other countries haven't had. I mean, the US and UK, of course, were spoiled because we have had access to the vaccines almost for, you know, many months. Since January, the Indian government has vaccinated, I think, somewhere on the order of 10% of its population, which is an amazing achievement, actually, for a country of that size and that income level. India is the engine of vaccine production for COVID. Many of the vaccines that the West uses are actually made in India. I think using the vaccine cleverly is the way out for India for this. Who's really vulnerable to this disease? This disease, if you're over the age of, say, 70, the death rate's very, very high, except, you know, 90. The survival rate is something like 95%, not 5% mortality rate or higher is very, very high infection fatality rate if you're over 70. If you're under 70, it's much lower, something like 0.05%, 99.95% survival, according to a whole sequence of studies. So you have this thousandfold difference between the risk of death from people that are younger versus people that are older. The critical priority in India, and frankly, even in the West, is to protect the older population. And in the UK and the US, we've done that. We've prioritized the old for vaccination. And in a way, we've defanged the disease. It no longer is the case that you will have cases automatically leading to deaths in the US and the UK because the set of people who are most at risk from death from the disease have been vaccinated. India should do the same thing. Unfortunately, in January, when they had this opportunity, they vaccinated 10% of the population, but they did a couple of things wrong. One is they didn't vaccinate the old preferentially. Only, I think, 40% of the doses have gone to people 42% of the doses have gone to people that are 60 and older. I think that was a mistake. I think that if those doses had been concentrated on the old, we might have seen the cases spread in India, but we would not be seeing the deaths we're seeing. The second, and you know, we don't see, you wouldn't also see the hospitalizations. There'd be much less pressure on the Indian healthcare system as well. The other thing I think that they made a mistake on is, you know, there are a large fraction of the population in India had already been exposed based on these earlier seroprevalence studies. They should have used that information to prioritize who gets the vaccine. If you are already been infected, you are very likely protected against reinfection, and most likely even immune. The immunity that you get from natural infection is at least as good as the vaccine. Of course, it's worse that you had to go through COVID to get it, but it's still at least that's at one good outcome. Well, given that's the case, the vaccine should be used on people who were not previously infected. You could save a lot of doses, prioritize the people who were not previously infected completely unprotected, rather than giving the vaccine doses early on to people who were already protected from previous infection.
Well, that all makes a lot of sense, but what about now? I mean, you mentioned in January they should have done this. Given that India is in the grasp of this infection wave now, shouldn't the government lock down for, you know, 2 weeks or so just to get ahead of things?
Well, I mean, I think it's possible that it's peaked already. I don't think the lockdown will help stop the spread of the disease. Didn't work last time. It very likely won't work this time. And it, as we talked about beginning, it had a huge amount of collateral damage. I think the right thing to do is for is actually accelerate the vaccination campaign. The West should be helping. I mean, there's no reason for in the West for us to prioritize vaccinations for 20-year-olds who are very, very low risk of severe outcomes from the disease when there are elderly people, not just in India, but around the world, that are entirely unprotected. We should be sending our doses to places that have vulnerable elderly. There's no ethical reason why someone living in Bolivia is 80-year-old is less, a lower prioritized for a vaccine than a 20-year-old American. It doesn't make sense.
So there are,
as far as the immediate need, there are immediate needs. Pulse oximeters would help triage patients. So the West can help by sending medical, I think the United States is sending some medical equipment, but not at scale that would be necessary. Oxygen is in very, very short supply. There's you know, black markets in oxygen now with the price of oxygen 10 times. I think there some basic things like that would go a long way. We also have like monoclonal antibody treatments that might help that we can send. I think the focus of the disease has moved to India, let's use the resources that we have. I mean, US and UK are good friends with India. That's what good friends are for, is to help in time of need. I think this is that time.
No, absolutely. But the problem is that you paint this decision between an 80-year-old Indian and a 20-year-old Brit, for example. But if the vaccine rollout has not been age prioritized in the way that you describe, if Britain gives India its vaccines, how do we know that it will actually be used for the most vulnerable?
I mean, I think I'm no expert in diplomacy. I'm just a simple professor. But I think you could say, look, we'll send you this if you change your prioritization system. I mean, I think that you could condition it, and I don't think that the Indian government would blink at that.
Jay Bhattacharya, thank you for joining Spectator TV, and remember that you can get full access to the Spectator's online and print articles with a subscription. Just go to spectator.co.uk/TV offer, and we'll even throw in a £20 Amazon voucher when you subscribe for just £1 a week. Finally, has the pandemic revealed the true nature of the West's relationship with China? The historian Neil Ferguson argues in this week's cover article that while the perception of China is worse than it has been in many recent decades, the West also seems to be taking from the Beijing playbook. It's one of the ideas that he explores in his new book, Doom, the Politics of Catastrophe. Neil Ferguson joins me now from Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Neil, welcome to Spectator TV. Let's start by talking about this concept you mentioned of osmosis in war. What does that mean?
Well, this is an idea that I came across when I was reading Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, researching a book about World War II years ago now. The book was The War of the World. And the idea is that you kind of become like your enemy, even if you win. That's the notion. And it was an idea that came up in World War II, of course, because the democracies had to create enormous systems of planning and control to win World War II. And then in the Cold War, a recurrent theme of commentary from conservatives and from the left as well, think of George Orwell, was that there was a kind of convergence happening, and the United States and its allies were becoming more and more like the Soviet Union and its allies. This was an idea John Kenneth Galbraith wrote up in the 1960s. So this idea of the osmosis of war, that you become like your enemy, I think is relevant today, because there's a danger that we could become, are becoming more and more like our principal strategic rival, the People's Republic of China.
And what are the ways you think that this is manifesting in?
Well, there are a bunch. For example, Joe Biden on the phone to Boris Johnson saying, hey, we need to have our own One Belt, One Road initiative. There's the way that last year, when it was clear that COVID-19 was spreading more or less uncontrolled through the UK and the US, we copied much that the Chinese did. The idea of lockdowns was in many ways based on what China did after around January the 23rd last year, when they basically froze the Chinese economy and Chinese society. I saw an interview the other day with the other Neil Ferguson. I'm not him, the guy at Imperial College who spells his name a bit differently, in which he said, well, we didn't know if we could do lockdowns. And then the Chinese showed us as that it could happen. And then we discovered we could do it even though we're not a communist state. So that's another example. And I could go on. I think central bank digital currency is a good example. The Chinese have pioneered this idea. And suddenly everybody's saying, where's the Fed's central bank digital currency? Where's the Bank of England's? And the Bank of England has set up a task force to explore this idea. So across the board, I think we're seeing the osmosis of Cold War in Cold War II.
And what's particularly fascinating about that Neil Ferguson's interview is he said, we realised we could get away with it. And I remember writing a piece in February last year about China's Wuhan lockdown, thinking this can never happen in the UK. But then, of course, it happened all across the West. When it comes to this security versus liberty tension, do you think that a lot of the West's leaning towards security in the last year, especially on COVID, is because of this sort of state of emergency that we've been in, this global pandemic scaring people into this? And so after the threat is over, maybe we'll be less like China in that way?
Well, in Doom, I try to argue that it wasn't a straightforward choice between letting the virus rip and getting to herd immunity, as it were, naturally, and locking everything down. That was the wrong choice to think about. That there was a choice, it existed in January, which was to do what the Taiwanese did and the South Koreans did. They didn't lock down. In fact, Taiwan has never had a lockdown. What they did was to ramp up testing, because it was possible to test for the new virus very early on, once it had been genetically sequenced, at the same time to create a system of contact tracing, and then to be able to isolate or quarantine people who are suspected of being ill. They did that very quickly. And as a result, hardly anybody in Taiwan has died of COVID-19. I think the grand total is 11 to date, despite the fact that they're right next door to the People's Republic. So I think one obvious question for public health officials in the West is, why didn't you do that? Why did you sit around January, February, and into mid-March, really not doing very much at all? And then in mid-March, you read Neil Ferguson's report, panicked at the thought that there were going to be 2.2 million deaths in the US, 500,000 in the UK. And then you shut everything down in this very indiscriminate way that had lots of unintended consequences, the full scale of which I don't think we understand even today. So I think one has to realize that there were other options, but we decided, and I think it was a wrong decision, to copy the People's Republic of China rather than to copy the Republic of China, Taiwan. If we'd copied the Taiwanese playbook, we would have had, I'm absolutely sure, significantly less excess mortality and much, much less economic disruption. Now, you could say, contact tracing apps on our phones, that sounds like a terrible threat to civil liberties. But I can assure you it's a smaller threat than being under house arrest, as a great many of us were for a large part of last year. I mean, if it's civil liberty to be shut in your own home under a shelter in place order, then as Ian Hislop once said, I'm a banana.
Although Taiwan does shut down its borders pretty early on because it was suspicious of the People's Republic of China, I mean, do you think that's an acceptable trade-off to make?
Throughout history and times of plague, there have been restrictions on travel. And one of the stranger things about 2020 was how slow the US and the UK were to realize that. It was clearly not wrong for Donald Trump to argue back in January that there should be a travel ban, that there should be limits on passengers coming into the US from China. But he came up with the idea a couple of weeks too late for it really to make much impact. And of course, there were exceptions. So US citizens and green card holders were exempt. The same is true, by the way, today. Indians can't travel freely to the United States, but Indians with green cards can, and US citizens who've been in India can. And that isn't going to stop the Indian variant from arriving in the United States. So yeah, I mean, the Taiwanese response, which of course had its counterparts in Australia and New Zealand and other countries, was the right one. When there's a new pathogen running amok in a country, you should stop people coming from that country, regardless of what passport or visa they have. That's the kind of knowledge that they already had about plagues back in the Middle Ages.
And let's talk about the Cold War. You mentioned in your book that Cold War II has already started, and you argue that China is the aggressor to this. From what I've been talking to people with in China, and whether it's academics or people, they actually think that it's the West who are itching to start a Cold War II. What do you say to those people?
Well, as a visiting professor at Tsinghua, I have quite a few Chinese academic friends and friends in the world of Chinese policy. I've been struck by how readily they've accepted the Cold War II analogy. There's not a lot of pushback when you make this kind of argument. Of course, as in the first Cold War, the communist side always argues that it was the West that started it. But this is a pretty unconvincing argument, I think, when you look back on Xi Jinping's track record since he came to power in China, because really from that moment on, China's been far more explicit in its geopolitical and technological ambitions. And as I try and show in the book, discussions within the Chinese intelligentsia are really quite explicit about the objective of displacing the United States as the dominant world empire with the People's Republic of China. When you think about the way in which China has increased its national security expenditures, its capabilities, its militarization of the South China Sea, its increasing assertiveness towards other Asian countries. Think of the way it's been beating up on Australia recently. It's kind of hard to claim that Cold War II started in Washington as opposed to Beijing. And I think we're rather in the US in the same situation that we were in at the beginning of Cold War I. In the 1940s, when George Orwell and Winston Churchill said, we're in a Cold War, most Americans were very slow to accept that. There was a sort of denial that persisted almost until the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950. And I think we're still at that stage now in Cold War II. A lot of intellectuals at Stanford or Harvard would say, no, this isn't Cold War II. That's the wrong analogy. We should be striving for co-opetition with China, which is a hideous word. But I think this is the stage of denial that you typically find in the West at the beginning of a Cold War.
Well, I guess part of their worries is probably that, you know, in a Cold War, as we saw in the 60s, you know, we had people on both sides kind of characterizing each other as these one-sided, one-dimensional players and actors. And in many ways, China is not quite like the USSR, is not ideologically driven in the same way that the USSR was. It seems much more keen on lining its pockets wherever possible. So do you think that the Cold War mentality, you know, sorry, the Cold War parallel has limitations in how to understand China as the new strategic threat?
Well, I think it's true to say that in Cold War I, there was a great deal of caricaturing of the other side, but that wasn't by any means the worst thing about Cold War I. Also want to mention the nuclear brinkmanship and the proxy wars that cost enormous numbers of lives from Southeast Asia to Central America and Sub-Saharan Africa. I think you can have a Cold War without those things, certainly without the nuclear brinkmanship and the proxy wars. But I think it's almost inevitable that in the way things are currently going, that the rhetoric on both sides is becoming more and more hostile, and attitudes towards the Chinese government are becoming more and more negative in the Western world. The Pew Group showed that with some remarkable survey data back in October. But my argument for Cold War II is not an argument against a happy and cordial relationship. I just don't think a happy and cordial relationship is possible with this Chinese government pursuing these strategic goals. The thing we're trying to avoid is hot war three. I mean, we do not want the US and China to end up in a shooting war, whether it's over Taiwan or the South China Sea or some other issue. And the great point of Cold War I was to avoid World War III. It was to avoid a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union, and it did that. It contained the Soviets' expansion pretty peacefully in the sense that there wasn't a head-to-head war over Europe. And I think that's really the point of Cold War. You'd rather have a Cold War than a hot war. And I think that's why Cold Wars happen and why ultimately they're preferable to making a series of miscalculations, which I think we're still well capable of doing, that produce World War III. It's not difficult to imagine a major escalation happening over an issue like Taiwan. And if you talk to people in the US military, I think of my old friend Jim Stavridis, who's just published a novel about this, the scenarios are pretty terrifying, because a US-China war would very quickly escalate from the Taiwan Strait to bombing of mainland targets, and then potentially to nuclear exchanges. That's how Stavridis imagines it in his novel. So as I've been arguing now for more than 2 years, you'd rather have Cold War II than World War III.
Okay, so you say that we should compete with China, but not copy it. So what does that competition look like?
I think it looks like what we currently see in the realm of vaccines, where the West is able to take advantage of its technological edge and the greater competition that there is when it comes to vaccine development in the Western world. I mean, the competition between companies, biotech companies like Moderna and BioNTech, is one of the reasons we ended up with mRNA vaccines. I think it looks like that in artificial intelligence. One of the striking things about AI is that the US still has a qualitative lead, partly because the best Chinese researchers in AI end up working in the United States and often stay and ultimately become citizens. So I think this is a technological contest. I think Cold War II will be much more a race in technology than Cold War I was. Of course, there was a tech race, a space race, in Cold War I, and I think there will be in Cold War II, and a cyberspace race. And right now, the US leads in, I think, most of the key domains, but it will not continue to lead unless it really does maintain that level of investment in research and development and competition, which is really the key to producing the best results. And so we mustn't make the mistake of thinking that the way to compete with China is through economic planning. And by my count, we now have three plans coming from the Biden administration in the form of major legislation, huge amounts of expenditure, total bill of around $6 trillion. And I look at that and I ask, are we about to repeat the mistakes of the 1960s and 70s, when it seemed as if the only way to compete with the Soviet Union was to do economic planning the way they did? That turned out to be a completely wrong conclusion. And the way the United States won the Cold War was, in fact, with a free market economic model under Ronald Reagan, not with the kind of thing John Kenneth Galbraith was arguing for in the 1960s.
Well, actually, I'm intrigued that you brought up Chinese researchers and scientists in AI, for example. As you know, in America and in the West in general, there's been a greater suspicion of Chinese nationals or ethnic Chinese working in STEM areas. What role do you think they play in this sort of future competition between the two great powers? Or should they be welcomed into the West, or do you think that we should be careful about what they can take back to China?
Well, this is a huge issue in a way that it wasn't in Cold War One. There were relatively few Soviet citizens in the United States at any point in the Cold War. There were in the later part of the Cold War exchanges, but they were on a tiny scale compared with the really huge amount of exchange that there is between China and the US. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese students until recently at American universities and often studying STEM subjects, a really significant number of graduate students working in key areas such as artificial intelligence or quantum computing. And it's true to say, and this is something that we know from the FBI, that there has been espionage as a consequence. We know that the Chinese government uses all kinds of means to try to hack Western technology breakthroughs, often through cyber means, but also through human intelligence. And this creates an enormous problem because, of course, if one Chinese national working at one big tech company turns out to be a spy, then suspicion falls on the others. And unfortunately, that can include American citizens, often people from Chinese of Chinese heritage who've lived in the United States for many years. So I do think we have to remember that one of the bleaker features of American history in the 20th century was the way in which hostility grew towards German-Americans in World War I and World War II, and of course, in World War II, towards Japanese-Americans who were treated shamefully. We mustn't repeat that history, and I do see dangers of that. A few years ago, more than a decade ago, I used the word chimerica to describe that period of symbiotic interaction between the US and China. Well, there are many Chimericans, and some of them are good friends of mine. These are people who may have been born in China, but have worked for many years in the United States and have become American citizens. When I became an American citizen, by far the largest group alongside me in an Oakland auditorium were in fact people born in China. And so we can't cast aspersions on the commitment of Chinese Americans to the country they've sworn allegiance to. If we start doing that, we're going to be back in the bad old days of the 1940s. And I, of course, I'm very conscious that I'm talking to someone whose surname is Yu, and may be encountering in the UK some of the kind of anti-Asian prejudice that one reads about on both sides of the Atlantic. That can't be the way this plays out. It is the Chinese Communist Party that we are concerned to combat in Cold War II. We do not want the CCP to become more powerful in the world than it already is. That is quite different from expressing antagonism to people of Chinese ethnic origin.
Neil Ferguson, thank you so much for joining Spectator TV. And you can read Neil Ferguson's new book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, which is out now. If you enjoy that conversation, you might also enjoy my podcast series, Chinese Whispers, where I look into Chinese politics, society, and its history. A link should be up on the screen now. And that's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests. As ever, send any thoughts you have about the show to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. And to make sure you never miss a future episode, click subscribe on the bottom right of the screen to follow our YouTube channel. See you next week.